This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible in big thanks to Archaeological Research and Supply, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, Royal Gold, and Papa and Barclay. Thank you very much. Couldn't do it without you. What we have here is a mystery on our hands, and frankly, we're not going to solve it in the next hour, so let's just call it Chapter 1. In fact, we may revisit this from time to time. The plot includes lawyers, pot, money, anxiety, and we pick up the story right next door to us in Nevada. A reporter who covers cannabis issues is there and encounters a soft-spoken yet intense biologist, a PhD researcher, in fact, named after a Jungle Book character, Mowgli. You'll be hearing about him. He's sleep-deprived because he's worried, concerned about a few somewhat hazy, secretive companies with millions of dollars seeking control of the marijuana industry early on by patenting nearly everything in sight. The implications, he tells the reporter, are immeasurable and could force some small operators out of business and maybe even impede medical research. Hearing all of this is reporter Amanda Chicago Lewis, who is an investigative journalist and a columnist for Rolling Stone magazine based in Los Angeles. Producer Larry Trask and I spoke with her by phone recently.
Las Vegas, November of 2016. Amanda Chicago Lewis is at the Marijuana Business Daily conference there. While there, she meets biologist Mowgli Holmes, who runs a research lab in Portland. He said there was a story he wanted to tell her about, and that it was a story that needed attention and some unraveling.
He told me about the existence of these wide-ranging cannabis plant patents that covered huge swaths of genetic variation that had already been filed and approved, some of them in the United States, some of them internationally, more patents pending.
Lewis comes away from the conversation thinking this is not going to be easy. She starts by confirming the legitimacy of what Holmes had just told her.
And so from there, I spent some time just trying to investigate exactly who these people were behind these patents, how legitimate were their legal claims to the patents, and what had really happened here and what did it mean.
She kept running into the name Gary Hiller of Phytex and Biotech Institute, known to be interested in biotechnology and nutrition research. Hiller is also a lawyer with work experience in technological innovation and intellectual property issues.
I found, at least a dozen companies that were affiliated with Gary Hiller. It was sort of like there were known quantities and they were all kind of floating around and it was unclear who was involved with the actual patents and who was maybe just part of this constellation of people. And then the real question for me was, where is the money coming from? Because that sort of would tell me who actually owns the patents, right? There's a lot of fear in the cannabis industry around these sort of secret potential corporate takeovers. A lot of rumors about Philip Morris and Monsanto and other really big companies that allegedly have secret cannabis plans in place. And people are pretty nervous about that. And of course, those companies do have a pretty big incentive to keep it secret. So the question was, like, would I be able to trace this back to some major mainstream company that quietly was buying up these patents?
Following the money, she found a lead, but not necessarily a final answer.
I did find that a person who seemed to be financially bankrolling a lot of Gary Hiller's activities is this Iranian man named Sean Sedegat, whose family's fortune came from cosmetics packaging. And there was a lot of evidence pointing toward his potential involvement in the patents, though he, I'm pretty sure, denies that he was involved in the patent specifically. So it's all very complicated, and lots of people have reasons to be secretive.
Concerns around this issue run the gamut. Consolidation of patents into just a few hands, the potential for encumbering medical research, and the expansive nature of some of the patents.
You know, it's very broad. This is why Mowgli was so concerned about it and wanted to talk to me about it, because one patent covers something like any plant with more than 3% THC, more than 3% CBD, and like no myrcene. Basically, the patents are not on individual strains. They're on like cannabinoid and terpene profiles that are incredibly broad and cover hundreds and hundreds of strains. In terms of like, what are we potentially missing out on if one company actually does begin enforcing these patents and saying that other people are not allowed to breed or research or experiment in any way with the plants that they have patented, we could be missing out on the greatest potential medical revolution of the 21st century, you know, because if we actually put the money and the laws behind doing research into the frankly like pretty amazing things that cannabis can do, that could change healthcare globally.
Of course, an unavoidable question when dealing with this issue is whether there are parallels with the Monsanto situation, where giant agribusinesses own thousands of patents on technology, seeds, plants, chemicals, machinery.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real fear. The crazy thing about Monsanto and what happened right in the agriculture industry is that it went from genetically modified plants, which were like, okay, yeah, you did spend a lot of money to create that, to just any plant. Just like the flexibility on being able to say this was pre-existing in nature, but it was a very specific variety, and I was the first person to like bring it to the patent office, so I own it. That's just a really slippery slope. There's good arguments for and against the idea that patents stifle innovation or that they promote innovation. You know, it's sort of, it's more complicated than just all patents are bad or all patents are good. But it's putting cannabis in the position of going in the same direction as corn and things like that. However, there's this vibrant industry that already exists and has existed for years and years and years. It just had to operate in the shadows. And so that complicates public domain in what I think is a unique way.
Always a story to be found and told in Las Vegas, huh? You can find Amanda's work and follow her full reporting on this issue at AmandaChicagoLewis.com. And it's important for us to point out, too, that those who are seeking these patents are not doing anything illegal. Joining us now in studio is Nat Pennington of Humboldt Seed Company. Find him at HumboldtSeedCompany.com, an enterprise that could be impacted by patents. And on the phone with us from Portland, Oregon, is Beth Schechter. She's the executive director of the Open Cannabis Project, OpenCannabisProject.org. And Beth, I'm going to start with you. Your bio says that your mission is to, let's say, unscramble or straighten out the world on this issue. Is that right?
That's close. I mean, I'm using an un F-bomb, actually, in my bio, but that's I'll take the unscrambling of the world. Yeah, I mean, I think in general, we have a lot of unscrambling to do. I try not to think too much in the kind of dire apocalyptic terms that I was brought up with all the time, but I think it's safe to say that there are some places where things could use some fixing. And one of the areas I think that could use some fixing is, you know, getting more information about cannabis into the public domain.
Sure, that seems to be one of the big problems. Nat, the same thing to you after hearing from Amanda Chicago Lewis there, your initial thoughts.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that we could be concerned about. I mean, I think it's also important to look at the positive things that have happened in the last 20 years here in California with medical cannabis and with this regulated marketplace for
all
better
the innovation that's all the happened innovation. Here.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people working really hard to do it. I think, you know, at the Open Cannabis Project and as part of my business, we just want to make sure that there's equity and equal opportunity and that the plant and the medicine can help people as much as possible.
This is an issue, obviously, that screams for a legal analysis, and we think we have the right guy for that. He's Dale Hunt. He's an attorney with Hahn, Loser & Parks in San Diego, and interestingly enough, he's also a Ph.D. in biology. He has experience in patents and intellectual property issues, and we'll be hearing from him several times. First, his general thoughts on patents as relates to cannabis.
See, the whole public policy of the patent system is that if you invented something and you really have something new, you should be able to protect that in exchange for disclosing it to the public and eventually letting it go into the public domain at the end of your monopoly. But if what you're claiming to have invented is already in the public domain, you shouldn't be able to pull it back out of the public domain and have a monopoly on it. So the patent examiner's role is to basically protect what's in the public domain from being taken out of it. So they look to the whole universe of prior art, patent literature, academic literature, sales brochures, anything. They search the entire universe of accessible information to see if what you're claiming is new or not. So you apply that to cannabis, and you've got a big problem. Because what academic literature is there on cannabis? What patent literature is there on cannabis? The examiner has to look at what you're alleging is new, but you've got this almost complete lack of any kind of searchable information about what was in the prior art. Because while there was probably all kinds of commercial activity and all kinds of creative activity in the world of cannabis, there's almost no record of any of it. It's a problem. It's a unique problem. It may well be a temporary problem, but it's a problem. How in the world is a patent examiner supposed to know whether something is new or not?
So, Beth, back to you after that. It appears, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that Open Cannabis Project and firms like, for example, Phytex and others are in a race wanting to get as much prior art, as Dale called it, information into the literature such that it becomes easier for patent examiners to find it, read it, and maybe decide in favor of a public domain designation. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I would say, and I don't know if it's a race, but we are certainly going as quickly as we can to do it. Yeah, and I guess a race is a fair way to say it. Yeah, because this stuff is happening very quickly. The patent system in general, like, tends to favor people with, you know, large bank accounts and corporate interests. And my interests are that of the people in general. So, yeah, we need to do what we can to work as quickly, as not quicker, as people who may be our competitors in this case. Though I would like to say I believe in an ideal world where we're all able to come together and work on this issue together. But I do understand that there are probably some actors who do not have the public interest in their hearts and minds when they're making these decisions about patents.
Right. Nat, to you, as the operator of a seed company, this debate could have real-life consequences for you and your business. Is that right? Explain that.
Yeah, it definitely could.
In what way?
Well, you know, for example, we've been breeding and, you know, in compliance with the Proposition 215, sharing seeds throughout California mm-hmm. for quite a while now. Yeah. And, you know, what we really want to make sure that we can do is continue to operate. And if one of these patents that covers a broad spectrum of different varieties is granted, and then the company chooses to, you know, enforce that
right.
against, you know, something that, that my company or any, there's, you know, thousands of seed companies out there, anything that one of us is doing, then that would certainly be a big financial hardship.
And you would have to pay them then to continue to make it available.
Right. Either pay like a licensing right. fee that they might levy, or they could just simply, you know, cease and desist letters mm-hmm. and then take civil action right. against.
And if you had to pay a licensing fee, does your margin allow for a whole lot more overhead or not?
Well, no, definitely not in the current framework that we have, and, you know, which is really tough, and there's a lot of burdens on the cannabis industry, or the community, I like to say, here in Humboldt County, that, you know, it's really tough already. And so at least looking ahead and supporting the Open Cannabis Project, supporting folks that are out there trying to protect our small businesses mm-hmm. is very important, because I guarantee you that everyone, you know, that's got a cannabis permit would agree with me that it's hard enough as it is in Humboldt County and in the state in general. There's a lot that is being expected.
And Beth, I'm guessing you hear stories like that from small business folks all over. Is that right?
Oh my gosh, all the time. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And do you give them hope? I mean, there's a lot of work to be doing, and there are a lot of lawyers working in the other direction. What do you tell them?
I mean, I think that we do give people a lot of hope, and that brings me a lot of joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things to work against in our, like, you know, political and national climate right now. And Open Cannabis Project is something where people really can, you know, come together and work together to help and solve this problem that really does affect the entire industry, whether you're a large company or you are, a farmer or a breeder who's working on a very small scale. Knowing what is in the public domain and all the prior art that we have helps everybody. So it does give people a lot of hope. And, you know, it is also, like, scary and in some ways overwhelming to think about all the people who might be working against us. But honestly, I have a ton of faith in the cannabis community. Yeah. I've never worked, you know, I'm relatively new to the industry myself. I'm about 7 months in after, you know, doing a lot of work in open source technology development and community development and curriculum writing. And I would have to say that this community is really unique in that it's, you know, it's accustomed to having to kind of work against larger forces. And so those forces that people feel might overwhelm some communities or might overwhelm some individuals and maybe cause them to back down. But this is a community that doesn't back down. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like, we have every right to be angry in this, you know, in this matter. So, yeah, there's a ton of work to do, and I'm not intimidated by it anymore. I'm just in some ways kind of angry that it even has to happen, but yeah. That kind of fuels my fire every day.
Yeah. We are just getting started on this, and a little bit later we're going to be including your calls and comments. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles, and as we go to our first break, a Cultivator Minute from Seth Geddes of the Beneficial Living Center.
Well, this time of year, spring planting, soil amending is on everybody's mind. I encourage everybody to get a soil test to understand the chemistry of your soil. Understanding the starting point of your soil chemistry is critical. With the rain right now, a lot of people are feeling antsy and behind schedule, but one trick you can do to save some time is you can go ahead and broadcast a lot of your minerals right now in the rain, like your calcium, your potassium, magnesium. So you can take these minerals and you can broadcast them out now and let the rain kind of water them in. Getting your minerals out, you can still do while it's raining if there's a break in the weather without having to till it in. And then you can either till in a low amount of nitrogen and plant immediately, or you can go ahead and plant and then meet your plant's nitrogen needs simply by top dressing. So a note to all the compliant farms this year, you're required to track the pounds of phosphorus and nitrogen that you are putting into your farm this year. So make sure to start that tracking now. Save yourself a headache. And a tip is most people are applying too much phosphorus, a significant amount of more phosphorus than is needed. So keep that in mind when you're doing all your math and you're buying your nutrients. You may not need as much phosphorus as you've applied historically. My name is Seth Geddes with the Beneficial Living Center and Garden Supplies on South G Street in Arcata. If you have any questions about soil chemistry or soil microbiology, give me a call at 707-633-6125.
Back to the Humboldt Chronicles, continuing our conversation now with Nat Pennington of the Humboldt Seed Company and Beth Schechter, Executive Director of the Open Cannabis Project in Portland. To tee up the next part of our discussion, we go back to attorney and biologist Dale Hunt in San Diego regarding plant patents.
If someone has bred and selected and cloned and propagated asexually a special strain of marijuana that has some great features, and they want to make it so that they can commercialize this and sell it and not have someone just get their hands on it and profit from that person's labor, they can patent that strain and make it so that no one else is allowed to propagate it without paying them a royalty or without their authorization. When people talk about patents without defining it as a utility patent or a plant patent, they're almost always talking about utility patents. You know, a patent that's on a tractor or a drug or pretty much anything else, that is a utility patent. And there's a requirement for novelty and non-obviousness and utility, a few other requirements to be able to get a utility patent. And those patents are examined for those things. And a patent examiner looks at what is called prior art, which is pretty much everything that was in the public domain, public knowledge, to determine whether what is claimed as a new invention really is new and really isn't obvious.
Utility patents he mentions in there. Let's get a little more info on exactly what a utility patent is in the context of marijuana plants.
Suppose you're trying to get a utility patent on a marijuana variety, and that is also possible. Then you have a lot more work to do to establish the novelty of that. And that gets a lot more complicated because you're then not just claiming it as being distinct from its parents, and you're not trying to just protect against its being asexually propagated, which is all that a plant patent protects. See, a plant patent gives you narrow protection just against the asexual propagation of that variety, while a utility patent gives you the luxury of claiming anything that's new. So if you're trying to get a utility patent on a plant, you can claim it any way you want, as long as what you're claiming is new and isn't obvious.
Beth, following on what Dale says there to you with this, when Amanda Chicago Lewis talked with Mowgli Holmes about this topic in Las Vegas, he told her, and I'm going to quote here, utility patents are big, scary. All of cannabis could be locked up. They could sue people for growing in their own backyards. Is that still the case, the way you understand it?
So I think that, you know, and for based on what I'm learning about utility patents and how they're enforced, I mean, in some ways, yes, that's still the case. You know, if you are infringing on somebody else's utility patent, which, again, as Dale has mentioned, covers not only, you know, a single strain or cultivar, but it can cover, you know, similar strains or similar cultivars, cannabis plants with similar THC, CBD, and terpene profiles. That's why they're dangerous, and that's where they have their teeth. What's interesting is that, you know, one of the questions that I've been looking into is, you know, when something like, for example, like a Monsanto violation happens, how is it that Monsanto actually finds out about that violation? Do they have people who are going and like checking farms for, you know, strains or for plants that might be similar? How does that work? And, you know, I don't have a comprehensive knowledge of every single Monsanto violation, but looking into, for example, Bowman versus Monsanto, which was a Supreme Court case that from back in 2013, you know, somehow, some way, Bowman, the person who brought the case, he actually contacted Monsanto and let them know about what he was doing. And basically what he was doing was taking, he had taken some seeds that belonged to Monsanto, and somehow, some way, they had bred with some other seeds that he had gotten, and then he had these hybrid seeds. Right. And he was trying to say that he had a right to use those seeds. And Monsanto came back and was like, no, that's not true. And then the Supreme Court ruled basically that, like, you know, even if the seeds were kept in, you know, even if it was like an accidental sort of like, you know, co-breeding, an accidental breeding between the two seeds,
right,
they still blamed the farmer for it, Mr. Yeah. Bowman. So he still had to pay his penalty. So I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, maybe can bring a little bit of solace amid all of this fear around these patents is that, you know, it takes real work to actually get somebody to enforce one of these. Now, if there's a patent that's so broad that it covers 90% of the industry, which I don't know what the numbers are because, you know, we're still learning about what's out there in terms of, you know, plants and their terpene and, you know, cannabinoid profiles. You know, if you have a patent that covers 90% of that, then it's fairly easy to go around and be like, let me take a look at your plant. You know, oh, looks like one of our patents. You violated the patent. That's still a ton of work, and it's unclear at this point how one of these patents would be enforced. Yeah. And I think that based on my understanding of how contesting patents works, you know, the truth of how powerful these patents really are will come from, you know, either the first cease and desist order of one of those patents or by litigation brought forth to contest the patents.
A higher tattletale somewhere, huh? Nat, to you, these utility patents that we're talking about here, how might they impact the seed business? And tell me what you have going on down the road here.
Yeah, well, you know, it's definitely concerning, especially just being that, you know, to reiterate, the prohibition of cannabis has left this sort of vacuum of what we call prior art or existing cannabis varieties.
And it's kind of a unique situation in the law.
It is. It's really unique. And, you know, so what I think is obvious is that cannabis is something that people have had a relationship with for, you know, time immemorial.
10,000 years or so?
Sure. I mean, there's, at least, you know, evidence of
about 8,000.
Oh, there you go.
Robert Clark.
See? 8,000.
Yeah.
That's long enough.
Yeah.
That works.
Long enough. Yeah, exactly.
Shouldn't that be considered prior art?
You would think.
Yeah.
And that's certainly, I think, just the kind of hard evidence. But, you know, we can all sort of hypothesize that it's basically, it's been a part of us since kind of the beginning. And, so because of that, I think the idea of slapping a broad patent to, you know, somebody like me and really a lot of community members in Humboldt County that would prevent us from doing maybe, you know, what we've been doing for so long, or things that we may have been even a part of developing and helping to bring into fruition, having that kind of taken away, and, you know, that's a tough pill to swallow when we think of those kinds of an idea.
It is. And some of the information, and Beth, you're aware of this, I'm told. You have some ideas about storing some of this information. Is that right? Tell me about that.
Well,
maybe we'll break some news here.
Sure. Yeah, I think it is breaking a little bit of news. So, you know, part of the Open Cannabis Project, which I'm on the board of directors as well, is, you know, this tough work, which I'm sure Beth could attest to, of compiling data and actually like building programs that are, you know, make the data easily examined by patent officers and easy to input as well.
Which is a key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, Beth, quickly, do you want to go over what's happening with that?
Yeah, sure. I'm very excited. We're actually going to be, we're working on a new build of our database currently. And, you know, without boring people with too much technical stuff, which also I get pretty excited about, you know, we are going to be releasing a new database around on May 12th at the Cultivation Classic in Portland. So if you can make it up to Portland and check it out, you absolutely should. And primarily what we're doing is we're setting up systems that for now primarily work with labs and get data from the labs. And the reason we're doing that is because, well, there's a lot of reasons. One, there are some technical challenges that come with, you know, scanning a bunch of individual PDFs that have, you know, lab results on them. It's, you know, it's not always easy for a computer to read what the numbers are saying in those images. And then, you know, there's an issue around like data entry for, you know, somebody, like, say you're like, oh, I have my lab results. I want to upload my lab results. Well, like, then you're like doing a bunch of data entry and there's a lot of room for error. So, our new database, which, is going to have, I can't talk about some of the things yet. But anyway, we're going to have some new data in it, and we're ultimately going to be inviting every lab out there to contribute their data and to talk to us about how to do that ethically and safely and in a way that really promotes data verifiability. So that way, if, you know, anyone, any patent officer or anyone really who's looking at the data set and wondering, like, you know, is this the most, like, up-to-date data? Yeah. Were there errors? Have those errors been corrected? We're building it in such a way that allows for that. So
you're gonna
it's
be
pretty
kind
exciting.
Of a,
more coming soon.
You're going to be kind of a hub for this information then, is that right?
That's the idea.
That's correct, yeah.
And
want to make it...
Go ahead. A quick point.
And I was just going to say...
This data, it's a choice. So the farm or the individual that's submitting the cannabis to have chemotype analysis or genotype analysis, it's all like voluntary whether you want it updated into the project.
Absolutely.
You know, the project.
Yeah,
open
absolutely.
Source data.
I mean, I believe, you know, and ultimately that depends on, you know, what's what any given lab will do with your data has to do with, like, the, you know, individual, the terms and conditions that you may have signed when you got that data. But, you know, I'm moving forward with this under the assumption that, like, the data belongs to the farmer or the breeder or the person who submits it. So, you know, going forward, there will be, for participating labs, there will be an opt-in similar to an opt-in for using something like Confident Cannabis. Getting historic data, which is, you know, where a lot of this prior art information really lives, is going to be a little bit trickier and likely will involve a bit more back and forth between labs and customers who have already, who've already produced their data, right? So we're still figuring out how that will look for labs who haven't really thought about this process before. So it's, we'll see how it works, but, you know, we're part of the reason why we're looking to, you know, we're in fundraising basically all the time because we're a nonprofit. And, you know, one of the things that we're trying to fundraise for is for developers who can work with labs to help them with some of the technical challenges that come around, that come with sharing their data. And part of it is the back and forth between customers and the labs.
And you know, Nat, just real quickly, we're going to take a break here in a second, but just real quickly, storing some of this.
So, yeah, we had talked about, with all of this incredible work that's going into getting this large database of prior art to protect, you know, this burgeoning industry from undue patents, what do we do? Where do we kind of store it? So we thought, hey, it'd be good to have kind of a disconnected hard drive stored in some safe locations, you know, maybe throughout the country or something like that. And so one thing that was generously offered by the Humboldt Patient Resource Center was their new dispensary is an old bank, and they have a giant vault in there in Eureka. So that building will be sort of one of the first storage hubs for some of this data, you know, because who knows what they're going to hack into next these days. So you kind of got to have this spot to
so
keep
put it.
It
in a vault and the Russians can't get it. All right. Our guest, Nat Pennington of the Humboldt Seed Company, and Beth Schechter of Open Cannabis Project in Portland will be staying with us. And next, we'll take a look specifically at how they plan to defend cannabis from overreaching patents. By the way, you can reach us at 707-786-5946 or via email at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. Before our break, though, let's go to a cannabis calendar minute. If you're in the cannabis industry or just interested in it, here are a few events going on soon that you might want to know about.
Welcome to this month's edition of the Cannabis Calendar, brought to you by the Humboldt Chronicles. The calendar features information on upcoming cannabis-related conferences and events that take place within a day's drive of Humboldt County. In honor of Humboldt Green Week, One Degree Consulting is hosting an open house and town meeting tomorrow at its headquarters in McKinleyville. There'll be a presentation by Dirty Business Soil Consultants, a panel discussion, Q&A session, and more. The open house starts at 10 a.m. and the town hall gets going at 3:20 p.m. More information is available at gohumboldtgreen.com. The High Times Cannabis Cup Social takes place in San Bernardino April 20th through the 22nd. Exhibitors, seminars, a cannabis competition, and an extensive musical lineup are all on tap at the NOS Events Center. You can find out more at cannabiscup.com. Finally, the Indo Expo comes to the Craneway Pavilion in the San Francisco Bay Area April 28th and 29th. Billed as the first business-to-business trade show in California since legalization, the Indo Expo promises seminars and exhibitors focusing on cultivation, extraction, lighting, nutrients, and processing tools, as well as services such as legal, IT, packaging, labeling, security, and real estate. There's more at IndoExpo.com. If you'd like to have your event listed on the cannabis calendar, email the details to studio@humboldtchronicles.com.
It's the best music. That is If You a Viper, written by Stuff Smith, 1936, popularized by Fats Waller. Cheers to you, Fats Waller, wherever your spirit is these days. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Here in the studio with us is Nat Pennington of the Humboldt Seed Company, and on the phone with us is Beth Schechter of the Open Cannabis Project in Portland. We want to bring you into the discussion now. If you have a comment or a question, you can reach us at 707-786-5946 or via email at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. This issue of public domain versus utility patents, which are patents, as you'll hear now from attorney Dale Hunt, that seek to put a big fence, as he calls it, around a variety of seed or plant or a kind of technology or machinery.
The way the utility patent system works is that the patent applicant makes a claim. They say, we invented this. And the thing they invented has to be defined verbally. You can think of a claim as a fence around whatever you invented. It's a verbal fence. It describes the limits of what you invented. And the patent examiner reads those words and then goes and looks for anything in the public domain that lies within that fence. In other words, the patent examiner looks for anything in the public domain that would demonstrate that the fence is too broad, that what you're saying you invented isn't actually new. And then the patent examiner will reject that claim and say it doesn't meet the requirements of patentability because either it's not new, it's just simply not new, or it's just so trivially different from what was out there that it doesn't merit patentability. It's obvious. So let's say that someone could prove that prior known varieties had a particular biochemical profile, and they could prove that existed in the public domain well before the filing date. That would have implications on the patentability of what was claimed.
And Beth, following up on that, going back to you, particularly with what you were saying before the break about collecting and storing this information through the Open Cannabis Project, what kind of help are you getting on this from the cannabis industry? Is it lots of help or is it just a lot of talk so far? How is that going?
So, you know, that's a great question. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the cannabis community, like many communities, is very wide in its range of, you know, opinions and knowledge about cannabis and patents. And, you know, it's interesting because you talk to some people and they're like, oh my gosh, absolutely, this is an amazing cause, how do I help? And you talk to other people and they're like, I don't really get it. And you talk to some people and they're like, but what if I want to patent my own strain? Are you going to come after me with your prior data and tell me that, you know, the strain that I have, the strain that I'm trying to patent shouldn't be patented? And, I mean, the answer to that is maybe. You know, I mean, ultimately, like, I think that what's great and what's happening right now is that we are starting to get way more support. Like, I mean, I was just looking in my our info at inbox today, and like there's a couple of labs that I've never heard of who are offering to share their data. You know, we're getting, what's really interesting too is that in addition to getting a lot of interest from people in the United States, particularly on the West Coast, we're now getting inquiries from people in Canada, in the UK, and other places in Europe who are really worried about these similar issues and looking for a place where they can document their strain. So, you know, I would also love more support, but at the same time, like, things are ramping up really quickly in a way that I don't think I quite anticipated. It's great.
And Beth, right before I go back to Nat, interesting there, it sounds like this is becoming international for Open Cannabis Project, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's very quickly becoming clear that this is an international scope. And, you know, one of the questions that's on the table that we haven't addressed yet either is, what about hemp? You know, where does hemp and patenting on hemp seeds and strains fall into this this conversation? So,
and are you working
on that?
There's
a lot to figure out. We are primarily working on, I mean, basically, if it's a cannabis sativa plant, we're working on that. I haven't dug into hemp specifically, but it's certainly something that we're starting to look at for sure. I will say, you know, again, not to go back to fundraising, but we could totally use some dollars so I could hire some help and not just rely on volunteers.
And people can contribute, I assume, at opencannabisproject.org. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
All right. Nat, kind of following up on that with you, as a small business person in this industry, in the seed business, where do you go from here?
Yeah, well, you know, I think an important distinction to make is the distinction between what I kind of refer to as defensive IP and then, you know, like what Beth brought up about, oh, I might, you know, want to file a patent someday or something like that. And really, there's, in my personal opinion, I'm not really speaking for the project or, but in my personal opinion, I don't feel like a plant patent is that terrible of an idea. So if you've bred a strain and Dale was explaining it as asexually reproduced, but you know, the common term in cannabis would be a clone. So this would have to be a clone of something that a person has created. They have to prove that they've done, you know, put a lot of work into it, and it's special and unique and novel. Protecting that clone only strain, it doesn't feel like that puts such a a hold on the rest of innovation and the rest of people's ability to develop something. And for example, like we've at Humboldt Seed Company put, you know, almost all of our varieties that we could, you know, afford to get tested and afford to put up genotype results through groups like Phylos Bioscience. Mm-hmm. We've made all of that public information, and that allows us to be able to reference back and say, look, in 2016 or whenever, we had this variety and it tested with these results and it had mm-hmm. this genetic makeup. It's stamped, it's in this, you know, public open data place where you can go see it. And that would protect my ability to continue working with that and to continue even, you know, selling seeds of it sure. and things like that. And so when what we're talking about at an Open Canvas Project is can be helpful from a business perspective, because it is defensive IP, intellectual property, and defending your ability to continue doing what you do is kind of, I think,
sure.
an important thing for, you know, especially I think Humboldt and places like this that have had, for better or for worse, this economic input from the plant. And, you know, we want people to be able to continue doing this.
Well, and around here, that's been going on since the late 60s, early 70s.
Of course.
So yeah. there's a lot of what we would now call intellectual property there.
Yes.
And with what you're talking about with clones, any cultivator could do that.
Yeah.
And then have.
Yeah. And you could, you know, take that fact that you have a patent and try to capitalize it on, and I'm not really endorsing or saying that, but that's just different than these utility patents, which really do cover a broad spectrum of different things and sure. they could, you know, cause us problems. And so I think that's important. And, you know, just to reiterate, the Open Cannabis Project does need support. It needs your data. It needs you to talk to the lab here locally that you work with and say, hey, maybe, you know, we can set up a way that the data is easily transmitted to the OCP. Also, if you want to donate, if you look at, like, our Instagram, the Humboldt Seed Company at Instagram, we have the link to their site, and there's a donate button. So you can click on that from our bio right now.
And Beth, following up on that, and going all mm-hmm. the way back to what Amanda Chicago Lewis was saying earlier in the show, where she discovered floors full of lawyers in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Thus the need for support for organizations like Open Cannabis Project. You're optimistic, though. I can hear that in your voice.
Oh yeah, I'm totally optimistic. I mean, one, I haven't seen these guys act yet. I don't know what they're going to do, but I know that they've spent a lot of money on this. And at the same time, like, we will just see. The truth is, I mean, the truth, the capital T truth,
yeah.
is that the claims that they are making, that the claims that are in Biotech Institute LLC patents that are being referred to, the claims that are being made, refer to plants that were in the public domain prior to the issue of the patents, period.
Right.
Cannabis and the community and the economic situation that we've had to work within because of prohibition is different from other plants, period. So we'll see what happens, but as far as I'm concerned, the truth is on our side. And, you know, I know that that doesn't always work in the eyes of the law in the short term, but I'm hoping that in the long term that it will. And I'm going to do everything that I can in my power to, you know, prevent future patents like these, and then we'll see what happens with this one in the future. And I have a feeling that this community will come together and work everything that they can to protect themselves and the work that they've rightfully done for the past however many generations.
8,000 years of truth with a capital T, right?
Yeah, I get a little fired up. I don't mean to get so emotional on the show.
That's a good thing. So one more time, opencannabisproject.org. You need the support, and it's a good organization to support. And folks can make donations there at the website. And again, your May the 12th, was it, event? Remind us of
that's
that?
That's right. May the 12th, Cultivation Classic, Database Reveal, Portland, Oregon.
All right. We want to thank our guest, Nat Pennington, Humboldt Seed Company. You can find him at humboldtseedcompany.com. Also, Beth Schechter, Open Cannabis Project in Portland, opencannabisproject.org. Also, thanks to Amanda Chicago Lewis, columnist for Rolling Stone magazine. You can find her work on this issue and follow it at amandachicagolewis.com. And we want to thank attorney and biologist Dale Hunt with Hahn, Loser, and Parks in San Diego. Larry, I'm guessing you learned something in the last hour. Is that right? What'd you learn?
I learned a lot as we were putting this episode together. I think the main thing that struck me was that the intellectual property landscape with respect to cannabis is unique unto itself. Unlike other areas, inventions that get patented, even agricultural patents, these things have been studied for years and years and years. So the prior art is out there. And it's searchable.
Right.
The prior art that exists with respect to cannabis is, in a lot of respects, not out there and not searchable. Mm-hmm. And that's what creates a very unique IP environment in cannabis that doesn't exist with respect to anything else, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, so much of it is anecdotal. And how would a patent researcher know that if they don't? You know, they haven't been exposed to it at all. That's
exactly.
And I think in one of our earlier shows, I don't remember which one, we were talking about this, that it's so unique because this was a commodity that had been considered illegal for such a long time, and now it's being brought to the marketplace. And that's just such an unusual happenstance in the law and in marketing that it presents these unique problems that we talk about.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, at lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. We want to thank again our generous sponsors, Archaeological Research and Supply, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, Royal Gold Soil, and Papa and Barkley. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you very much. We will be back with the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month, so we'll see you next time, which will be May the 16th at 6 p.m.